Welcome to the Humanist Union of Madison meeting. And Beth will introduce our speaker.
Hi, we're talking with Glenn, and he's talking about how the separation of church and state is eroding evolution, the theory of evolution. Thanks.
You can probably introduce yourself.
All right.
Give your title. As you...
Hi, this is Glenn Branch. I'm the Deputy Director of the National Center for Science Education, a nonprofit organization that works to defend the integrity of science education in the United States.
So, thank you for coming to answer questions after your presentation this morning, which was very informative.
Thank you.
Anybody here have questions?
Sure.
Shane?
So this is more focused on kind of like higher education, I suppose. I think some of the discussions in the meeting house were more focused on kind of primary and secondary education. But what's your perspective on kind of like the current administration's trajectory of defunding higher education and specifically scientific research? Does this parallel anything that has happened in historically, or is this kind of like unprecedented?
Yeah, I think it's unprecedented, although we'd all do well to remember that the high degree of federal involvement in and subvention of scientific research is really a fairly recent phenomenon. It comes about really at the end of World War II, when people like Vannevar Bush saw all of the things that science had contributed to the war effort and decided, look, we've got government and science entangled and producing a lot of things of advantage to the country. Let's keep doing that. And this sort of bargain that government will fund science and science will produce things of advantage to the country was pretty much in place from the end of World War II to the present day, where, again, the Trump administration's assault on scientific funding and scientific integrity in general is unprecedented.
When you were talking, you sort of were drawing a parallel, you just alluded to a parallel between evolution teaching and climate change. Could you flesh that out?
Sure.
Now we have time to do that.
Yeah. So some 16 or 17 years ago, we noticed that global warming was appearing as a target, along with evolution in certain kinds of anti-evolution legislation. And that was a little puzzling, because what do they have to do with each other? And we spent some time thinking about that. And we realized that as climate change was beginning to become part of American science education, K-12 science education, it was running into some of the same kinds of challenges that evolution education had been experiencing for so long. And we started asking around at other nonprofits, and we'd say, hey, who does for climate change education what NCSE does for evolution education? And everybody said, I don't know. And a lot of them added, why don't you do it? And we thought about that some more, and eventually did decide to make the move to add climate change to our portfolio, because the attacks are the same, the battlegrounds are the same, and there didn't look like there was any other organization that was willing to step up to the plate. There are differences. One is that climate change denial is driven primarily by political and economic ideologies, not religious ideologies. So that means you've got largely a different set of players to deal with, and you've got a more limited toolbox, because we do have the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution saying, look, you can't teach religious dogma as truth in the public schools, but we don't have anything saying you can't teach bad science in the public schools. That's perfectly kosher, no problem with that. So some of the issues go differently, but a lot of them go the same, and I like to think that we've been making a difference for climate change as we have for so long for evolution.
Is it the same players, basically?
No, it differs a lot, and going back to the ideologies. So you're dealing with creationism, you're mainly dealing with people with strong religious convictions about the inerrancy of the Bible. When you're dealing with climate change deniers, you're dealing with people who... Well, the way it works for climate denials psychologically seems to be they look at kind of the far end of the process. What are we going to have to change about what we do and the way we live in order to cope with the effects of climate change? And they don't like those. And then that kind of percolates backwards into distrust of the basic science. And if you don't trust the basic science, obviously either you don't want it to be taught or you want it to be taught as, you know, empirically shaky or worthy of disbelief. And so we don't so much, unlike creationism, there isn't a package deal alternative. In the case of evolution, you know, there's something called creation science, which is a particular form of creationism, and some people want it taught. There isn't a package deal alternative to the science of climate change. The best you get is things like, oh, maybe it's like driven by sunspots, or maybe the Earth isn't warming at all, despite all these satellite and surface temperature readings showing otherwise. And that doesn't really give you a whole kind of curriculum that you could teach instead of or alongside climate the regular science on climate change.
Are there examples of the National Center for Science Education testifying before state legislatures on laws that were proposed or they were trying to get off the books?
It's fairly rare. One reason is expense. Another reason is it typically doesn't look good for some out-of-state organization, especially from the famously liberal Bay Area of California, where we're physically headquartered, to march into a legislature in South Carolina or a Board of Education meeting in Arizona and tell the locals how to conduct their own affairs. Rather, we spend more time with locals, trying to get them organized, get them talking to each other, especially in ways they wouldn't have considered. Sometimes people are very surprised to find out that there are supportive clergy who will testify for the teaching of evolution and against the teaching of creationism. That can really startle policymakers who are not tremendously well informed about the variety of religious responses to evolution. That said, we did go down to Texas in, let's say, I think 2008, and Jeannie Scott and Josh Rosenau did indeed testify in front of the State Board of Education. At the time, it was headed by a creationist dentist named Don McElroy, who we managed to get on videotape explaining his conception of his role as chair of the Board of Education. He said, "Someone's got to stand up to the experts." We dined down on that for a year.
You mentioned in your talk the decentralization of school curricula and like the decisions that make what are the decisions that are made about what is taught is widely disparate across the country. And in my mind, that kind of goes to explain like why we have such division in this country, because we kind of live in two or more separate realities where people are taught a certain way of thinking and a certain way of how to think that is completely different even from the next county over, the next state over in some cases. Do you foresee there the possibility of there being kind of a national curriculum in the US, and would there be particular benefits or drawbacks to that?
Through most of the developed world, a national curriculum is the rule rather than the exception. The joke I've heard is that the French Minister of Education, sitting at her desk in Paris, knows what page of what book is open on the desks of every school child in France. Even countries that are a little less centralized, like the UK and Canada, still do curriculum at the national level, so the four nations in the UK, or the provincial level, as in Canada. So it's you know, Europeans find it very hard to understand why we do that, and you know, they're right. It is strange. Some of this goes back to historical reasons. A lot goes back to the fact that the majority of any given district's funding is raised by local property taxes. And it's kind of hard to go to the local property owners and say, well, we're going to take your money, but we're going to teach the national curriculum. So that would be a very difficult political lift, and I really have no idea how one could go about doing it. That said, there are some forces that lend themselves towards standardization. One is the rise of state science standards, which, as I said, goes back to the early 90s. It used to be, you know, the Wild West out there, particularly in the West. Now we're getting closer to a model that still doesn't narrow down curriculum and instruction, but it does somewhat. The other thing is that increasingly big companies are moving into curriculum, which includes nonprofit companies, so it's not all profit-driven. And teachers and their schools and districts faced with choices of, well, am I going to painstakingly assemble a bespoke curriculum myself, or am I going to buy one or get a free one off the shelf? And just given all the other demands on teachers and the administrators, the answer to that question is increasingly, I'm going to take one off the shelf. And that also leads to more standardization. But it's going to be a long time till we have anything resembling a national curriculum in the U.S.
Couldn't that be a real disadvantage, though, with the current political climate and the government and the state of education?
Well,
the national level could be anti-science.
The federal government, by custom and statute, has basically no influence over curriculum and instruction. So although local control does have the downside, it does have the upside that a maniac or a tyrant at the federal level just can't do much. If President Trump or before him President Biden had decided he wanted this or that taught, what's he going to do? Send an email to each of the 100,000 principals in the U.S.? And even if he did, what are the principals going to do? They don't take their orders from the President of the United States. They take their orders from the local school board.
Have you heard of any, on the national or federal level, any concern about maybe we should start injecting more money into science education? Kind of in the way that we are in competition with other countries and looking at how math and reading scores are not doing great nationally right now. Is there any sense of a Sputnik moment for the future where suddenly science and math become a priority for the administration or any administration?
I don't think there's any sense of urgency for science and math education with the present administration and arguably, you know, certain degree of hostility. The scientific establishment is still kind of reeling from the many assaults against it from the federal government, and I kind of feel it's not in a position to support an initiative about science and math education in general, possibly under the next administration, by way of reaction. Something like that will occur, but I wouldn't expect to see anything like that for a couple of years.
To that end, for your response, is there any organization, yours or an adjacent organization, that is keeping track of the collateral damage being done to NOAA and other organizations where long-term knowledge and experience is being maybe irreparably lost in some of these scientific organizations, so that we would know when the chips settle, what exactly have we lost?
I'm not aware of a central repository. I do know that There's been a lot of journalism to this effect. The New York Times had a kind of Anakley-driven series where they would go around to scientists who had lost their jobs or their funding and interview them. I think various nonprofits are probably keeping tracks of pieces of the puzzle. I'm not sure there's a single clearinghouse for all that kind of information. With regard to climate education in particular, which is something that I do follow, the federal government's agencies, many of them had information for educators on their websites about climate change, the USGS, NOAA, NASA, USDA for that matter. Previously, all of these were housed at a central clearinghouse, climate.gov, which has been shuttered, and I recommend the website climate.us, which was started by a group of former climate.gov employees to preserve and expand the climate.gov resources. So that's climate.us, and it is a new effort with a lot of valuable resources already, and it deserves support.
That's a non-governmental?
And that's a non-governmental nonprofit.
What's your perspective on the propagation of large language models in like education generally, but specifically with respect to science education? I know anecdotally, some people at the university and other universities in the country have struggled a lot with students not really studying to the extent that they used to, and instead relying on things like ChatGPT to give them the answers, which may or may not be reliable.
Yeah, I haven't really looked into it. Doesn't distinctively affect evolution education or climate change education, and those are sort of my myopic areas of focus. I find the whole thing very disturbing, but I would not say I have a very well-informed opinion.
Okay. I'm John, resident skeptic. And to be clear, I'm not a skeptic on climate change. But I've been watching a young woman who used to be a climate change warrior who has actually flipped and is now almost a climate change denier. And she actually makes a few good points that I just wanted to... One thing I've always been concerned about is how people assign blame to everything on climate change, like new record low temperatures. It makes no sense to me that that's a climate change related item. She also brings up saying that the worst forest fires of all time are happening now, but that's not true at all. Before forest management became an issue, you know, in the early 1900s, forest fires were much more prevalent. And then the other thing is she talks about CO2 not being a pollutant, and that plants are very happy with the increase in CO2. What do you do about, my concern there is that by overstating climate change effects, you lend fuel to critics.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. Not everything weather-related, good or bad, can be blamed on climate change. You actually have, if you want to make an, as they say, attribution claim, you actually have to do the science to back it up, and it's not enough to wave your hands. So that's a perfectly reasonable observation. Also, in general, I'll note that practically any skeptical or denial claim involving climate change, you can find a refutation written at different levels of detail for your convenience at a website called Skeptical Science, skepticalscience.com. With regard to increased cooling in some areas, bear in mind that the Earth is not homogeneous with regard to climate.
She actually doesn't talk about that.
Well, so the climate system is complex, and the fact that average global temperature is increasing doesn't mean it gets hotter to the same extent everywhere. Rather, it means there are different local changes depending on different local circumstances. So, for example, the Western Europe is a lot warmer in general than it should be, owing to the Gulf Stream. If changes to the climate system actually cut off the Gulf Stream, That means Western Europe's going to be a lot colder. So there's nothing paradoxical about global warming causing Western Europe to become colder. With regard to CO2, there's actually a lot of information on this. It's within a particular range that more CO2 will aid some plants' growth. But if you give it too much CO2, it'll actually hurt the plant's growth. And calling CO2 a pollutant, you know, what's a pollutant is, this is important because the EPA had regulations in place regarding pollutants, and then they started classifying correctly excess CO2 as a pollutant. But, you know, the key word here is excess. No one wants to remove all carbon dioxide from the ecosystem. That would, you know, kill everything. So that would be a problem. So, you know, these are not good arguments, and they don't withstand any kind of scrutiny. But as you will know, it's not always easy to have these conversations.
I think the undeniable piece is that climate itself is changing, whether you think it's a benevolent change or not. And human beings, since the beginning of the Holocene, have done very well for ourselves in a very stable environment. And when you have 8.5 billion people on planet Earth living in a changing environment, that now calls into question what our future will be.
Well said.
Right, especially if the sea level starts rising, it's going to cause a lot of mass migration, which Trump would love, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've always thought they should have called it climate disruption.
And some people do. The folks at Climate Central propose climate weirding, which I kind of like.
Sounds like a Dune reference.
Yeah, I feel like that, and one narrative that I've also heard is that this is not unprecedented, these levels of carbon dioxide that we're heading towards in the history of the Earth, but what is left out of that is humans weren't alive and when those times of elevated CO2 levels were around, so we have no evidence to say that humans can continue surviving at these levels or the changes that are going to happen because of that.
That's right, but also it's important to look at the slope of the line, because what's unprecedented is not the levels of CO2, but how fast they've occurred.
Yes.
And Michael E. Mann, now at the University of Pennsylvania, displayed this in a well-known graph many years ago and dubbed it the hockey stick graph, because it just swoops up at the end.
And also just the idea that it's not just CO2 is increasing and temperature might be increasing globally, but there are a whole host of tipping points that are complex that when we cross that tipping point, there is no off switch for that. And that represents the real catastrophic, terrible danger that this climate phenomena poses.
Yes.
Like releasing all the methane in the Arctic.
You're right.
Something along those lines, yes.
And the Arctic temperature change is huge right now, right?
Right, like 4 degrees Celsius.
Yeah.
Collapse of the West Antarctic ice sheet, or the meridional overturning circulation stopping, or any of those.
Does the National Center for Science Education have a recognized expert in climate change that gets called on from time to time, universities or whatever?
We don't have one on staff, but we have very friendly relationships with a lot of climate scientists, and at any given time, we probably have some leading evolutionary biologists and climate scientists on our board of directors, so we can nag them if we need advice.
Which brings up, how are you organized?
Well, NCSC is a 501c3 nonprofit corporation. We're run by an executive director who oversees the staff, and she is overseen by a board of directors. So, nothing very fancy.
Do you have publications that are made available to high school principals, the teachers, and that sort of thing?
Yes and no. Right now, the main focus that we're doing for educators is running regional conferences, and so we will send a couple of our people out there, out somewhere, and have a very intense week doing evolution education workshops or climate change education workshops with in-service teachers.
And those are held around the country?
And those are held around the country. Right now they're working, they've got something called a My Coast, which involves place-based education in these areas, and these, as you might expect, take place around a coast. I think the last one they did was in Galveston, Texas, and given what it's like for teachers in Texas, it's nice to be able to give them a little treat. But we've also got something called DataWise, which is about data literacy, and we can do that inland.
How welcoming have your group been when they go to these areas that are in tension, shall we say, with these ideas of evolution? As far as like both the educators, and have you received any pushback from the public?
We haven't received any pushback. The teachers, of course, are to a degree self-selected because, if someone doesn't want to go, we can't make them go. So we've had a very good response from the teachers and their administrations.
Perhaps a change of pace, but evolution, I feel like, is very often kind of a backward-facing science, where we're studying the fossil markers and the course of how evolution has occurred over what we are able to study. But obviously we are continuing to exist and going to exist in the future. Do you see any evolutionary pressures that are being exerted on humanity right now? And what's your perspective on the next stage of human evolution?
So probably nothing's interesting in a science fiction-y way. I mean, obviously we'd all like for our descendants to have huge bald heads with throbbing veins. No guarantees, and that's very hard to predict. I personally have been kind of interested in the work of Joe Henrich at the Harvard, who's a evolutionary anthropologist who looks a lot at evolutionary changes in cognition, human cognition, and that's very interesting. And he kind of has observed that most psychologists look at a very strange, or as he says, weird, and that's a acronym, and I don't remember all the bits of it, but industrialized, educated, rich democracies is, don't remember what
the Western educated, thank you, Western, rich democracy.
That's it, thank you. And he argues with reference to a very wide database that the cognitive processes of all of us, people in this room, have been evolutionarily formed in along a very weird path that most of our ancestors and a lot of people occupying the planet with us right now don't take, which involves, among other things, thinking in a particularly analytic fashion, and which is not good and bad of itself. It is good for navigating the kind of so complex social structures we have built around us. So we cope with and often flourish in a kind of complicated, rule-bound social structure that is very much alien to people living in more traditional societies.
Although, have you seen the movie Idiocracy?
I have not, but I know the general.
It does seem that, from an evolutionary standpoint, it seems like the more educated people are, the fewer children they have these days, which is probably counter to the bald head, the large head argument in the future.
Of course, it's comedy, and it's not necessarily well thought out in many ways, so I wouldn't endorse it as a prediction.
I mean, the basic principle seems reasonable, though, that
In the end, the principle isn't that reasonable, because it's looking at an individual's education level, which isn't necessarily a measure of their intellectual capacity. And when we're looking at the whole genetic an evolutionary process of, you know, people being able to pass down hereditary traits. Yes, there is an epigenetic factor involved in having higher education, but, you know, somebody without the higher education can also have, you know, genes for higher cognitive capacity. And we've also seen that IQs have steadily been going up over the past...
For the 20th century. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
On the other hand, GPS is decreasing the size of the actual, the parts of the brain that are locating, you know, following clues to where you are.
And of course, people in traditional societies are not dumb. They're extremely smart.
And they're really good in that area.
They're really good at coping with the challenges of their environment, which can often be extremely demanding. They're really good at living in the kinds of social systems they find themselves in. So whether or not they would, you know, flourish at Harvard is neither here nor there.
And they don't have the crutch of GPS.
I love my GPS.
I'm trying to keep that part of my brain alive.
Mine is completely atrophied.
Hawks has mentioned that this, over time, the size of the human brain seems to be shrinking.
You said John Hawks's?
Oh, okay. Professor.
Yeah, that's interesting because I read a study recently where they were talking about there wasn't as much crooked teeth in early humans, and it's because their jaws were wider. And that jaws become narrower as we need less space for the brain, even though our cognition is higher, like we're doing more things with our brains. Then, so it's kind of a weird paradox that they're looking into right now, and people have a lot more crooked teeth now because our jaws have narrowed the whole skull.
They also had better teeth, less tooth decay.
Mm-hmm. And don't believe in evolution, you just discard all.
Now, if you really want to win, so you should look at the paper about the Neanderthal they found, where they had people around
the
them
had
a root canal.
Yes, with no, obviously no.
And
well, we don't know what they used for painkiller.
We don't know, but
there may have been some.
I shudder to think.
Yeah.
You can't even bite down on a stick if they're doing a root canal.
Yeah.
Right. We underestimate, I think, the coping ability of ancient peoples. Badly, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Does the National Center for Science Education get involved internationally with other groups in other countries that are confronting some of these problems?
Well, there tend not to be groups in other countries confronting these problems because they don't have as many of them or as regularly as we do. The only, I think there have been Canadian and British ones, both fairly short-lived. We do work with people and ad hoc coalitions in other countries where they're experiencing problems, yes. And they're often amazed that the U.S. can support an organization that specializes in these problems, but they're usually very grateful because we know, even if we don't know as much about the educational system that's in place, we do know a lot about the kinds of attacks that are being launched on it. And so we have worked very effectively, I think, with the overseas organizations and people facing challenges to evolution and climate education.
How healthy is your organization in terms of funding, support, and membership?
Well, we would always like to have more funding, more support, and more membership. And you can join NCSE by visiting ncse.ngo. But we're really quite comfortable. We've been very prudent in our stewardship of the funding that we've got. We got $1 million stock donation over the transom recently, which made us all very happy. I think we're financially secure.
Thank you.
Do you work much with the Freedom From Religion Foundation in your work?
Well, I stopped by and got the tour of their office on Friday, so that was fun. Historically, we have not, but I don't think there's any particular reason for that, just we haven't gotten around to it. I'm kind of hoping now that we've seen each other face-to-face, we'll work a little more closely. I was pleased to be able to work in those couple of slides in my talk about the K-pop Act, which FFRF helped to get off the ground, and like to see more of that.
You might be a future guest on our Free Thought Radio program.
That would be nice.
Now I know where the anti-science originates here. Where is it? What is the drivers in other countries? You said that some other places are facing this. What are the driving forces there?
Well, there's kind of two, let's start with evolution. And there are two main sorts of anti-evolution efforts overseas. One is basically exported from the U.S. So after the fall of the Soviet Union, for example, evangelical missionaries were all over Western Europe and into Russia and bringing creationism with them. Likewise, in South America, evangelical missionaries, Seventh-day Adventist missionaries, Pentecostalist missionaries, although they're typically not as invested in anti-evolution, so all through South America, for example. And so there's that. In other cases, there's kind of native forms of creationism that's mainly going to be in English-speaking countries, Protestant English-speaking countries. So the UK, South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, Canada all have kind of active creationist organizations with a lot of cross-fertilization with American creationist organizations. In fact, the guy who runs the U.S., the largest creationist ministry in the U.S., Answers in Genesis, is an Australian, Ken Ham, from Queensland, which is the Bible Belt of Australia, and largely because of evangelical among U.S. forces stationed there in World War II. So it goes back and forth, back and forth.
So we exported it.
We have exported it and we re-imported it in the person of Ken Ham and some of his colleagues. In some cases, locals will take the American creationism and kind of use it for their own purposes and change it in the process. So there is an Islamic creationist organization called Bali Araştırma Vakfı. My Turkish is probably terrible, which means Scientific Research Foundation, but it's more familiarly known by the pen name that its publications appear under, Harun Yahya. And even that pseudonym has religious significance because Harun is Aaron, who is the spokesperson for his brother Moses. Yahya is John, the forerunner of Jesus. So the Harun Yahya folks, as I'll call them, first were working with the U.S. Institute for Creation Research, but the Islamic tradition doesn't particularly call for a 1,000-year-old earth, 6,000-year-old earth, and doesn't call for a global flood, so they just left that stuff off. Later on, the Harun Yahya people decided, no, we're going to take the intelligent design stuff instead. That's easier because it has fewer details that then don't have to be etched out. And then they decided just to do their own thing. The founder and main force of the Harun Yahya thing is a guy named Adnan Oktar, who used to be fairly friendly with President Erdogan of Turkey, but that didn't last, and he is now serving a multi-thousand-year sentence in a Turkish prison. In other cases, just some of the American creationism is taken up. In India, for example, some of the BJP and the RSS platform involves claims that Hindus are the original, aboriginal inhabitants of the subcontinent. And some of this involves pseudo-archaeological claims and claims of the historicity of various, you know, legends in the Rig Veda and other Hindu scriptures. And some American creationism gets kind of pulled in to support some of this, you know, essentially politically motivated pseudoscience and pseudo-history and pseudo-archaeology. The Hare Krishna people, or the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, has taken on board a lot of the intelligent design stuff, but as far as I can tell, this is mainly for export and doesn't have a lot of currency within India itself. So things get very strange in the world of creationism. The further you get away from English-speaking Protestant nations, my former colleague Jeannie Scott had a lecture tour in Japan, and she got back and she was telling us about it. She said, "Oh, and I met the Japanese creationist movement." And we said, "What was that like?" "He was very polite."
What would you say is the best known publication of your center?
Oh gosh, so I mean, we're not a publishing house. Jeannie Scott wrote a kind of textbooky thing called Evolution versus Creationism, an Introduction, which had two editions, and the paperback of each edition was published by the University of California Press. That's got a lot of attention. Jeannie Scott and I published a kind of collection of essays in 2006, right after the Kitzmiller case, called Not in Our Classrooms, Why Intelligent Design is Wrong for Our Schools, which I think is pretty good. And, you know, we're often invited to, write for popular publications or scholarly publications. So Jeannie Scott and I, again, in 2009 had an article in the Real Life Paper edition of Scientific American, which was nice to have. I don't even remember what that was called. The Latest Face of Creationism, I think that was called.
Now you said she's retired now. Is she still doing any writing?
Jeannie Scott is retired and spending a lot of her time doting on her granddaughter. Mm-hmm. She is, I think, trying to cut back on writing and speaking, but she still does some. And if you go to NCSC's YouTube channel, we try to put up any recorded talks that she or any of the rest of us have done. So that's a good place to look.
Do you think that there's any, when you look at the situation in the UK in particular, they're very, the Anglican Church is very entwined with British public schools, like not Eton and Harrow, like literally they're what we would call a public school. And they have religious education in K through 12. And I do wonder if there's any correlation there with the fact that they have religious education in school and yet they don't seem to have the kind of problems that we have as far as people resisting the teaching of evolution, or at least not to the same extent.
Yeah, so the nature of RE in British schools, it's supposed to be objective and non-devotional. And pretty much anything they teach in a RE class in British schools, you could teach in a U.S. school if you had time for it without having any problems. Mm-hmm. So things about history and sociology and philosophy of particular religious traditions, including non-religious traditions such as humanism. That's not always the case, and every so often there'll be a little fuss when someone is teaching creationism as scientifically credible in an RE class in Britain, and then they have that fuss and they tell the teachers to knock it off, and usually they do. So it seems to work okay there. Religious belief is at a fairly low level in the UK, despite them having a state church, or possibly because of them having a state church.
Because of it, maybe.
Yeah, that's been argued. And the rate of acceptance of evolution is quite high. The main hotbed of creationism, insofar as they have one, is in Northern Ireland with Protestants. The late Ian Paisley was, among his other accomplishments, a fierce creationist.
No more questions. Let's give our applause.
Thanks very much.